and Azerbaijan, looking for places where maybe Zionism could be fulfilled. But in order to make sure that the new Jewish movement does not give up on the idea of Palestine as an exclusive destination for implementing Zionism as nationalism, the Christian Zionists were very important in pressuring the Zionist movement not to change course and to hone on Palestine as the main destination. And these Christian Zionists were holding important political, economic, and cultural positions on both sides of the Atlantic. Now, another myth that, of course, is immediately connected with this and is very relevant to our day is to equate Zionism with Judaism and therefore equate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. And I think many of you were accused in your time being anti-Semites because you declared yourself to be anti-Zionist, or if you are Jews yourself, or being self-hating Jew. Again, the problem with challenging this kind of equation is that you need some space and some patience of your interlocutors to understand that this is the wrong equation, that Judaism is religion and Zionism is ideology, and there are a lot of Jews who are not Zionists, and there are quite a lot of non-Jews who are Zionists, which shows you that this is an ideology that is beyond one religion or the other. But you will have to recount the history of the Zionist movement, how it becomes, how it transformed from a very marginal idea into a more powerful force. And it doesn't happen by itself. There is a very strong lobby that makes sure that Zionism becomes more and more equated with Judaism. You need a strong lobby, and you need a very devoted advocacy, because for many people this does not sound very reasonable and valid. At the heart of all of this is something that I think quite a lot of people ignore in history. And that is the fact that the leading or the leaders of what is called Anglo-Zionism or American Zionism, that is the leader of Jewish communities who devoted their energy for the sake of Zionism, have never themselves thought of emigrating to Palestine. And if you look at the way the American Zionist movement developed, you can see that at the kind of a more hidden level of motivation was the fear that without Palestine there would be an influx of poor Jews from Russia into the United States. And that's one of the main reasons that some American Jews supported Zionism. Of course, they didn't say it aloud, because that was not a very nice thing to say for supporting the colonization of Palestine. They supported the colonization of Palestine because it was the homeland of the Jewish people. But not in America. There was, of course, another problem, that if Judaism is nationalism, there was always the danger of being accused of dual loyalty as well. So Jewish nationalism was fine for people in Romania, in Russia, but not for Jews in America. Because if Jews in America would say that their nationality is Jewish, then they are open to accusation of dual loyalty. And the same is true about British Jews and French Jews and so on. So this is a complex relationship that shows you that Zionism, more than anything else, contributed to anti-Semitism rather than being the panacea for anti-Semitism. And anything that happened in the last year or two just proves the point that this is what its main effect is on the relationship of the Jewish communities in the world with each other and with the other societies. Now, if we move closer to our time and we want to debunk mythologies that are still at the heart of the way mainstream media, mainstream politics, and mainstream academia in this country interpret Israel and Palestine, which also feeds their ideas for the best solution in the future, we go back to 1948. And it's incredible to see, even in the left in America, and not only in America, that for many years, probably unintentionally, people were ignoring 1948 as the beginning of the story, or as a pivotal moment in the story. Anyone who worked endlessly and religiously for a two-state solution, and I was there myself, I will have to admit, in my youth, was ignoring the importance of the 1948 and the Nakba for the history and present and future of Palestine. And even when you heard the Secretary General of the United Nations very bravely and courageously, and should be commended for it, when he said we should understand that the events of the 7th of October did not happen in a vacuum. And he immediately says, what I mean is that what happens on the 7th of October happened because of 56 years of occupation. No, my dear Secretary General. It happened because of 76 years of occupation, not 56 years.
You're listening to Ilan Pape on Myths of Israel. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To order copies, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
This kind of history that is not being told or is not being told properly is important because you have to talk about what happened in 1948 as an act of ethnic cleansing, as a crime against humanity. And you have to understand the connection, for instance, between what goes on in the Gaza Strip and the events of 1948. For instance, there was no Gaza Strip before the Nakba. The Nakba produced the Gaza Strip. Gaza was a cosmopolitan town on the Via Maris, the road from Alexandria to Alexandretta in Turkey, where a lot of people and goods and ideas were passing. It was organically connected to Jaffa in the north, to Beer Saba in the east. And it was part of a district that included many villages and small towns. Now, in 1948, when the Zionist forces began to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians, they pushed the Palestinians in the north to Lebanon and Syria, the Palestinians in the middle to Jordan, or what became the West Bank, and they wanted to push the Palestinians in the south to Egypt, to the Sinai Peninsula. But like today, Egypt then as well refused to allow Palestinian refugees to cross the border. So Israel had, the young Israel had a problem. So they decided to create this rectangle that you can see on the map as the Gaza Strip, as a huge refugee camp, as a receptor for the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians that they expelled during the second half of 1948 from the south of Palestine into Gaza, making the Gaza Strip the biggest refugee camp on earth. And the last wave of villages that were forcefully removed and its house burned and demolished were the villages that are today, on the ruins of these villages today, are the Jewish Israeli settlements that were attacked by the on the 7th of October. So you need to know that history for understanding what was going on also on the 7th of October and not just in the Gaza Strip itself. 70% of the people who live today in Gaza, 70% are 1948 refugees. And many of them are from villages and towns which are very near to the strip itself. Not to mention the fact that the international indifference to the ethnic cleansing in 1948 provided encouragement to Israel to continue the ethnic cleansing in other means after 1948. Because after all, in 1948, Israel succeeded, in inverted comma, only to ethnically cleanse half of Palestine's population. And many of the refugees remained in Palestine itself, in refugee camps in the Gaza Strip and refugee camps in the West Bank. And many others remained in refugee camps near Palestine. So in order to complete the incomplete ethnic cleansing of 1948, Israel continue ethnically cleansing Palestinians, first from inside Israel until 1967, and then after occupying the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, not on the same magnitude as it expelled them during 1948, in a more incremental way, but nonetheless, hundreds of thousands, to my account, about 450,000 Palestinians were expelled from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip between 1967 until the 7th of October, 2023. What I see today is an Israeli decision to use another method in order to complete the ethnic cleansing of 1948, and that's the method of genocide. And the first phase of genocide finished in the Gaza Strip. We don't know the numbers. People are talking about 40,000. But what we hear from United Nations officials about the many bodies under the rubbles, we're probably talking about 200,000 people. And now Israel is moving into a genocidal operation in the West Bank under the pretext of another mythology, that they're actually preempting an Iranian proxy war against Israel. But this is just a pretext for beginning a genocidal policy toward the Palestinians in the West Bank, and I'm afraid that the next station after that are the Palestinian citizens of Israel. This is a messianic Zionist, or as Nur Masalha calls it rightly, a messianic neo-Zionist government that believes it has an historical opportunity to complete the total de-Arabization of Palestine from the river to the sea. And this opportunity will not repeat itself, and therefore, contrary to the way the American administration looks at the situation, are very much in favor of escalating the situation into a regional war, because like the Christian fundamentalists that believe that a huge explosion, violent explosion, a doomsday war, Armageddon kind of war, is part of the divine scheme that opens the way for a different kind of period in the future. And we should take seriously these notions and the way they are being translated into policies on the ground. I would like to finish by talking a little bit about the mythologies that are connected to the future. But I think that one of the major challenges we have in trying to spread the word or to inject a new, an old new kind of dictionary or vocabulary into the way we would like people to talk about Palestine, about the situation today and about our hopes for the future. And some of that language, I'm very happy to say, has been adopted also by the solidarity movement here, by the encampments. And when people ask me what is the difference between the solidarity movement with the Palestinians in the 70s and the one that emerged in the last 10 or 11 months, I say that I think that more clearly the necessary vocabulary is being now adopted and spoken naturally. If these kids were born with this kind of dictionary. And that's very encouraging to hear that. And that is a non-nonsense approach to Zionism as a colonialist project, jettisoning the conversation about peace, replacing it with conversation about decolonization, challenging the Israeli notion of being the only democracy in the Middle East, by referring it to an apartheid state, settler colonial apartheid state, and by adopting a vision that is so beautifully, of course, encapsulated in the slogan, Palestine should be free from the river to the sea. I think this is something that is still a far cry from the way mainstream media, mainstream academia, and mainstream politics are talking about Palestine, especially, as I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, all this conversation on the day after is based on the two-state solution. The idea is to create another Bantustan in the Gaza Strip, similar to the one in the West Bank, and somehow hope that this is going to work. God knows where did they find the source of inspiration to think that it should work, on what basis, what books are they reading, who are they consulting, I have no idea, because so much nonsense being written recently on this. But whatever it is, if we find a way of injecting this conversation with the right terminology, I think we are going to be able to defeat the mythology, both in our academic works, in our activism, in our conversation, and insist that this is the language we should use. We don't use conflict, we don't use peace, we don't use two-state solution has been dead for so many years. It's lying in the morgue, everybody's afraid to have the funeral, but it's time to bring it into an honorary burial so that we can all have a closure and move on. And I'll finish. There was kind of a humorous moment in my conversation with the two agents in Detroit when they asked me, do I believe in the slogan that Palestine should be free from the river to the sea? I said to them that everywhere there's a land between two sources of water, people should be free. Yeah. But one of the guys wanted to show me that he did listen in his geography classes, and he said, what about Bulgaria? I remember he said. I said, okay, everywhere between any two sources of water, I'm sure there is, I haven't looked at the map, people should be free. I really believe that it's time that we will use the same language in our academic courses in universities, stop teaching Palestine in political science department that deal with conflict management and conflict resolution, move it to modules for decolonization, genocide studies, anti-colonialism, and let's defeat the oxymoron, academic courage. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Sigil. I'm actually the co-chair of DSA International Committee's Palestine Subcommittee. And DSA is Democratic Socialists of America. We're kind of big tent. And I was curious, you mentioned that there was a time where you also believed in the two-state solution, or two-state delusion, as I like to call it. And we still have some comrades, I think, that believe in that. And so especially Jewish comrades, I'm wondering, how can we help have that conversation? And like, what was it for you as someone who grew up there, was Jewish? What was it that made it click for you and made you into, you know, such an uncompromising and staunch anti-Zionist?
As for the question of the two states, first of all, we have to admit that whoever represents the Palestinians today, whether it's the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian political parties inside Israel, they still subscribe to the two-state solution, which is one of the reasons, I think, some members some people who are part of the solidarity movement with the Palestinians would say, why should I adopt a position that those who represent the Palestinian Liberation Organization do not adopt? I'm not more pious than the Pope. And that's a difficult issue. But I do think that it's important to engage with people on the issue itself rather than on questions of who represents whom rightly or wrongly. And if one doesn't see the moral weakness or deficiencies of the two-state solution, namely an idea that relates only to 20% of Palestine, that relates only to half of the Palestinians, that has nothing in terms of solving the Palestinian refugee problem, that is keeping Zionism, be it in only 80% of Palestine, still keeps it, this racist ideology intact. If that doesn't work, they only have to be 5 to 10 minutes in the West Bank, virtually or physically if they can, and to see that what Israel created in the West Bank is irreversible in terms of a two-state solution. I think it is reversible in a one-state solution. The fact that there are 700,000 Jews living in urban sprawls, not just isolated settlements. The natural growth is such that the number will double itself very soon. It's only if you want to apply transitional justice, which we would have to, through a process of decolonization to places, and not just the people who live in these places. This can only be done in a project that totally de-Zionizes and decolonizes Palestine, not in redeploying the Israeli army in such a way that creates these awful Bantustans that anyone living in the West Bank would tell you that life before Oslo was much better than life after Oslo. Thank you.
Hi, Ilan. I'm a rail worker from Toronto. I'm a big fan. Gaza in crisis was huge for radicalizing me, so thank you for that. I have a question about a narrative, maybe it's a myth, but this narrative is that models of class struggle and ideas of class struggle don't really apply to Palestine because everybody in historic Palestine, everyone from the river to the sea, is either too privileged to engage in class struggle because, you know, if you're an Israeli, you get free land and that sort of thing. You get free military aid from the U.S. So everyone's either too privileged or too oppressed. Like Gazans, of course, their industry keeps getting destroyed. Like you mentioned, it's like 82% of Gazans are refugees. Within the 48 borders, Palestinians are kept out of Israeli industry. And in the West Bank, one of the only jobs you can get is construction, building the settlements that are settling you out of existence. So this idea is that there's no real revolutionary subject or subject of class struggle because everyone either gets too much or is too oppressed to engage in class struggle. So I was wondering if you think that's a myth.
I'm from St. Louis. My Congresswoman Cori Bush was one of the first to call for a ceasefire. She's been the most pro-Palestinian, one of the most pro-Palestinian congresspeople. So then AIPAC spent $15 million to beat her by, you know, 5% or so, and I'm sure you've heard about this. But to me, it shows like a sign of desperation to spend that much money and to pull up all sort of tricks just to win by that little amount. I wonder if this is kind of like a sign, I hear you say, the beginning of the end of Zionism, if this is kind of a beginning of the end of it, just AIPAC having to go up that far out. And I'd just like to hear your thoughts on that.
What is the strategy we can use to push back so that these AIPAC campaigns to defeat Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush end up having payback so strong that we're going to actually end up helping to defeat and fight AIPAC? We have to make this cost. What are your recommendations?
First of all, about the class struggle in Palestine and the privileged Jewish society, I think it's a more nuanced situation. As a former member of the Israeli Communist Party, I know how we failed to create the coalition we always wanted between the Mizrahi Jews, who were the main component of the Jewish working class in Israel, and the Palestinians, who also were an important part, whether Palestinians from inside Israel or the occupied territories after 67. And it didn't work because of the way most of the Mizrahi Jews were de-Arabized and under the influence of some of their rabbis became probably in large numbers the base for racist anti-Arab policies in Israel. However, I don't think this is an irreversible process. There are a minority, but they exist, of Mizrahi Jews, call them Arab Jews, inside Israel, who definitely can be recruited and be galvanized for a class struggle that will go along the Palestinian liberation struggle and not against the Palestinian liberation struggle. But I do think it's important to analyze correctly the situation of the Israeli economy right now. You have 20% of the Israelis paying 80% of the taxes. Many of them are leaving Israel. They already began to leave Israel before the 7th of October because of the rise of the neo-Zionist messianic political forces to power in November 2022. The economic situation is in crisis, and the gap between those who have and have not does not includes also the Jewish society. It's not just an ethnic demographic issue. It's a classical class issue, and it's not the only place in the world where the left finds it difficult sometimes to recruit the working class against xenophobic, racist policies that are connected in the West to immigration, in Palestine to the issue of the occupation and the colonization. So I think this is something that should not be looked at only as it stays today, but we should allow our imagination to go beyond that. After all, most of the Jews who came from Arab and Muslim countries don't have dual nationalities. They don't have European passports. But they will stay in Palestine after the collapse, and the collapse will come. And they are much closer to the area, its culture, its language, despite 76 years of human engineering that try to disconnect them from their own heritage, identity, and language. The question of the AIPAC success, I do agree, actually, with the second, I didn't write names of comrades, but the second question. I do agree. I think the might used on one candidate or so on is a sign of weakness. It's not a sign of strength. AIPAC is part of a larger I don't have to tell you this, you're here in America, of a larger pro-Israeli lobby. It doesn't include only AIPAC, but AIPAC is an important pillar in this structure. And it's a very veteran advocacy group. It exists more than 100 years. And like all such structures, which are so old, that is, their longevity, also exposes their weaknesses. And the biggest weakness of AIPAC is connected to our work in the left. What I mean by this is the following. If we believe that politics can only be defined the way it is defined by our political elites today, then AIPAC works on a viable model. Mm-hmm. Then it works on a viable model. This is politics. Money buys you victory. It's connected to capitalism. It has nothing to do with the agenda of the people itself. Politicians are there for power, for the sake of power, for their own fulfillment, and so on. But if we believe, and I think we all believe, that, and there were some good indications in France that this is possible, that there can be a redefinition of what politics is. How does politics, or how should politics, represent the agendas of people? On ecology, on poverty, and so on, AIPAC doesn't have the tool to deal with such transformation. So because I believe the old kind of politics is not going to sustain for long in a world that faces global warming, poverty, diseases, and where people would have to rely back on human solidarity and intersectionality, and all the things and the left had believed in, I think that AIPAC, like the State of Israel, is using force because anything else they would have liked to use, which is moral arguments, human arguments, is not working. It's very clear that you can bomb people with F-16, but not their ideas. And the epitome for this is the Israeli idea that they can wipe up the Hamas. in Gaza with a genocide. The Hamas will survive. And unfortunately, a lot of people would pay the price, but the Hamas will survive the genocide of Gaza. It will remain there because political Islamic ideology is the one that seems to so many Palestinians right now as the only one that dares to resist the occupation and not collaborate with it. So it will remain a powerful, valid force as part of the Palestinian liberation movement. And the change in the civil society in the United States, the change in the American Jewish community, the change towards in the attitude towards the Palestinians in Israel cannot be stopped by money, political power, and all the other lethal methods that AIPAC has used over its 56 or 57 years of existence. And it is still effective because we have not yet changed the way politics is being done. But I do believe that this whole structure of politics, the way it has been done here and in the global north, is on very weak and precarious pillars that are shaking. It's like there's extensive cracks in the foundation of this building. Finally, no, there's no finally. I think that's more or less it. Yeah, thank you. Okay.
You were just listening to Ilan Pape on Myths of Israel. Ilan Pape has been called Israel's bravest historian. He's the author of many books, including 10 Myths of Israel. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Thomas Suarez, Michael Parenti, Naomi Klein, Chris Hedges, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. And we have a series of programs on the Middle East. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Ilan Pape, Myths of Israel, and for his classic book, 10 Myths About Israel, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Miles Davis, If I Could Write a Book.
at the various gatherings, the big gathering they had at Carnegie Hall for the 75th birthday of Paul Robeson, and you'll find the Harry Belafonte's, all of the towering artists who knew that they owed a tremendous debt to Paul Robeson. It's very interesting at that gathering. One of the most powerful words were said by Coretta Scott King at that gathering. She was still mourning the death of Martin, and she said, "America did to Paul Robeson what I think they ended up doing to Martin. They buried him alive." See, Coretta's hitting on something deep. Inexcusable treatment of a person who had the courage to tell America about itself in regard to its injustices. They bury him alive.
That's Cornel West, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Cornel West on the legacy of Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson is one of the 20th century's most enduring and multi-talented figures. He broke through the color line and excelled in sports, film, music, and theater. He became world famous, yet in the United States, he was to be persecuted and hounded for his political beliefs. In his recordings, particularly of spirituals and folk songs, Robeson's mellifluous bass baritone voice awakened African Americans to their heritage and gained him a broad audience. He won acclaim on Broadway, especially in the musical Showboat, in which he sang the classic Old Man River. His dramatic performance in Othello is legendary. By the 1930s, he was singing in major concert halls all over the United States and Europe. By the early 1940s, one biographer states that Robeson was the most famous black man in America. Theodore Dreiser, the well-known writer of the day, hailed Robeson as an artistic and social genius. Never content to be just an entertainer, Robeson had strong political views, and he wasn't afraid to express them. He condemned racism and segregation in the United States. He was an anti-imperialist who advocated the liberation of Africa and Asia from their European colonial masters. He was an early and vociferous opponent of fascism. He visited Spain and sang for the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, who were fighting Franco. He admired the Soviet Union and said so openly. After World War II, the U.S. was saturated in the ideology of anti-communism. The Soviet Union, erstwhile ally, was now the arch enemy. Robeson's support for the USSR did not waver, and for it, he paid a heavy personal and professional price. He was a target of Hoover's FBI. He was verbally and physically assaulted and attacked. One notorious incident occurred in 1949 in Peekskill, New York. Robeson would later recall the baying of the lynch mob, the cries for my life from the hate-twisted mouths. In 1950, the State Department revoked his passport, declaring that Paul Robeson's travel abroad would be contrary to the best interests of the United States. Here is Robeson in his own words.
"And why do they take my passport away? They have said so in a case. They put it in a brief. They said that no matter what my political beliefs, what my standing among the Negro people of my own land in America, but they would have to take my passport away anyhow, because out of my own lips, mind you, from my own lips, for many years, I have been struggling for the independence of the colonial peoples of Africa. And that is meddling in the foreign affairs of the United States government. Now, that's just too bad, because I'm going to have to continue to meddle."
Having his passport taken away was a tremendous blow to Robeson's career. He was not only unable to perform overseas, but he was blacklisted domestically. His income plummeted. The return of his passport in 1958 came too late. His final years were marked by depression and illness. He died in 1976 in relative obscurity. In recent years, because of important biographies by Martin Duberman and Lloyd Brown, as well as the work and efforts of others, there's a revival of interest in Paul Robeson. One can hardly imagine a better person to talk about Robeson's legacy than Cornel West. He's been called the preeminent African-American intellectual of his generation. He's the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Professor of Philosophy at Union Theological Seminary. With his preacher-like cadences and passionate delivery, he's much in demand as a speaker. A prolific author, his book Race Matters was a bestseller. He ran for president as an independent in 2024. Cornel West gave the first annual Paul Robeson Lecture at Columbia University Law School. This classic from the AR archives, marking Black History Month, was recorded in February 1999. And now, Cornel West.
I must say, I tremble as I rise and lift my voice to put forward reflections on Paul Leroy Robeson. There's levels of suffering, sacrifice, sadness, loneliness, courage that constitute such a formidable challenge for us to dwell into the complexity of his life. I congratulate Columbia Law School for having the audacity to begin a lecture series in the name of the great Paul Leroy Robeson. Now, I know he's class 1923. He wasn't too crazy about the place, we should say. He had very, very pleasant memories of the dean at that time, Harlan Fisk Stone, and classmates like Thomas Dewey and William O. Douglas. But he zipped through. He didn't practice law for too long, just a few months after being hired by a firm, Stonesbury and Minor firm. And after working on the will of Jay Gould, he was just a stenographer who said, "I'll never take dictation from a nigger." He decided maybe he ought to do something else with his life. Never took the bar. But in the best of the Columbia Law School tradition, his mind was sharpened. But as is true in most law schools, one wonders whether the mind is not only sharpened, but also in many ways narrowed. Can you sharpen your mind and at the same time broaden it, refine it, so that you have a sense of the whole rather than zero in the specialized, professionalized, routinized way in which so much of legal studies is often done? But you have no sense of what the larger calling actually is as public servant or as analyst for various firms who themselves have a collective and public responsibility. Paul Robeson, for me, terrifying. I've never had the gumption to speak publicly about Paul Robeson because he scares me. And you can bet your bottom dollar this is going to be the last lecture I give on Paul Robeson in a long time. Because it takes too much out of me. Well, let's begin where he would want us to begin, by situating him in a story bigger than himself, situating him in a set of narratives larger than himself, understanding Paul Robeson as a small part of a great, long, rich tradition of struggle. Going back to Robeson Plantation, Crossroads, Martin County, North Carolina, his father, William Drew Robeson, born a slave, escapes at the age of 15, makes his way to Pennsylvania, engages in farm labor to pay his way
through Lincoln University. His father, an extraordinary person, himself part of a larger backdrop, a wave in an ocean of those who came before, of many thousands gone, obtains his A.B. at Lincoln University, his ministerial degree at Lincoln University, and makes his way to Princeton after meeting his lovely wife, Maria Louise Bustillo, herself lineage of a grand tradition, grandfather from Sephardic Jews who encountered black folk in the New World, producing children like all of us, culturally hybrid. You see. And Princeton, of course, the very site where Paul Robeson was born, in his own words, spiritually located in Dixie, but geographically located in New Jersey. I happen to be a very proud holder of a Princeton degree, so I won't push this too far. But we know that Princeton was the only acceptable school for Southern elites. No accident, the first black went to Princeton in 1947, Harvard 1872, Columbia, you tell me. Princeton's always been behind when it comes to taking seriously the vicious legacy of white supremacy. Trying to catch up lately. God help them. Made some strides lately. But Paul Robeson was born in a Jim Crow context. His father was pastor of Witherspoon Street Presbyterian Church for over 20 years, but was pushed out because he was an outspoken critic of the Jim Crow situation in Princeton. Paul Robeson never forgot it. Paul Robeson had to leave Princeton when the father was pushed out. His mother died very tragically when he was six. She was brilliant. She wrote some of her husband's sermons, which is not typical in the black church. He moved a number of times to New Jersey, ended up in Somerville. His father had to change denominational affiliation to AME Zion because he couldn't deal with the deep racism in the Presbyterian church. And for many years, Paul Robeson lived alone with his father, the two of them. His father was 53 when he was born, an older man. Paul Robeson was a baby. Seven children, five survived. Paul Robeson had, in many ways, I'm saying, unbelievable privilege given the status of black folk at the time. A deep belief in himself, in his talents, in his capabilities. He thought about going to Princeton, decided to go to Rutgers, though his father wanted him to go to Lincoln. And of course, the record at Rutgers is unbelievable. All-American. Phi Beta Kappa in his junior year. Winner of the oratorical contest all 4 years, freshman year, sophomore year, junior year, senior year. First time Rutgers football team ever beat Princeton in the history of the game. You can imagine the smile that put on Brother Paul's face. And yet, as you can imagine, many schools like William and Mary and Georgia Tech refusing to play Rutgers as long as Paul was on the field. Graduates 1919. And then on to New York. Thinking about theater. Wrestling with the call of theater versus the call of law. And actually went through Columbia Law School while, in fact, he was an actor. I don't know how many of you are attempting that. It's a difficult thing to do. And it's not just a matter of learning lines in one context and memorizing cases in the other. But he pulled it off. And during the time here at Columbia, he met the love of his life, his land, Cardozo, good, Essay, herself Columbia grad. God bless you. The class of 1917 obtained the first position of a black person on staff at Presbyterian Hospital. Paul Robeson met her as patient in hospital with Essie as one administering to him. Long marriage, but we're talking about buffers, what he could fall back on. Why? Because we know in his life, from 1898 to 1976, he would need tremendous buffers in order to deal with the chilly whirlwinds, not just of white supremacy, but of Cold War, marginalization by mainstream black America, misunderstood, misconstrued, traveling around the world, doing what? Trying to keep alive this tradition of struggle. Always viewing himself as but one person to whom the baton had been handed to, and knowing he would have to hand that baton off to those who would come after. Paul Robeson, in many ways, reflects the plight and predicament of so many Americans, especially black Americans, who had attempted to do the same thing. Think of Frederick Douglass in 1893, 2 years before he dies. No blacks allowed to World Exposition in Chicago. But he, being a representative of the State Department in Haiti, is able to attend as a Haitian, but not as a black American. Wrestling with a despair at the end of his life. Think of T. Thomas Fortune, that grand journalistic crusader, dies all by himself in an old dilapidated hotel in Trenton, New Jersey. Think of Zora Neale Hurston, working for white mothers as a maid after writing such literary texts as Her Eyes Are Watching God, dying all alone. No tomb for the body. Think of Marcus Garvey by himself, London, Jamaica, late convert, Roman Catholicism, nearly forgotten. Think of Martin King's last years, the years that we would rather not think about. But he's saying over and over again, America is so much sicker than I thought. White supremacy saturates and permeates every nook and cranny. I thought I had victory. Is it relatively hollow as a Pyrrhic? Think of W.B. Du Bois. 1961. Joins the Communist Party at the age of 93. Leaves 2 days later and says, I spent my whole life trying to create a multiracial democracy. I cannot conceive of the masses of black people being treated decently and kindly and equally owing to the racist tilt of most of my fellow citizens of European descent, even given the heroic efforts of the well-intended ones. Take me to Ghana and don't ever bury one molecule of my body in America. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about a Paul Robeson. Not because he's perfect or pure or pristine, but because he had the courage to look himself, America, and the world in the face and say, I want to attempt to tell the truth about it. And anytime one attempts to show the ways in which our will to truth is untruthful about itself, the way in which the American will to truth is often untruthful about itself, you're gonna suffer. We know about Paul Robeson's two suicide attempts, 1961, the wrist, 65, the scissors,
the loving care of Paul Jr., unbelievably loving care of Paul Jr. and his wife, Marilyn Rosenberg Robeson, to keep Paul going during those 11 years of darkness, reminding one of the last years of Nietzsche and Hurdling and others. Not madness, but on the brink. What a price to pay, given the fact that in 1944, 1945, he was the loving Paul Robeson. Americans crazy about him, receiving awards from every major institution. Why? Because he was supporting the war effort. But so quickly it changes when you try to be a truth teller about America. Think of Muhammad Ali, truth teller, demonized. And after the progressive leaders and the black leaders are nearly dead, the political movements they represent relatively dormant, they're then resurrected. King the same way every January. Now he's a hero. Now Robeson, oftentimes affirmed, appreciated, but not just his body dead and gone, but what he represented more and more feeble in our society. Where are the truth tellers and witness bearers like Paul Robeson? I want to highlight three fundamental questions in regard to Paul Robeson. The question that I think pushed each and every one of us to the edge of life's abyss. The first question is, what does it really mean to be human? Especially coming out of a context in which one's humanity has been systematically called into question. What does it mean to be modern? Especially out of context in which the underside of modernity is the starting point. Slavery, Jim Crow, Jane Crow, second-class citizenship, desegregation. And third, what does it really mean to be American? Wrestling with the dark side of the American experiment. Three fundamental questions have nothing to do with self-pity, nothing to do with PC, nothing to do with somehow ghettoizing and marginalizing Paul Robeson or the tradition out of which he comes. Each and every one of us have to come to terms with those three questions one way or the other. And Paul Robeson recognized that first question, what it means to be human, takes him back to the Latin root of our word human itself, humando. Great Vico in The New Science, paragraph 12, reminds us humando means bearing. To be human has something to do with burying, has something to do with relating ourselves to mass corpses who are gone, has something to do with connecting us, the quick, to the dead. Has something to do with bringing together the three dimensions of time, of past and present and future. That's something very un-American to have that kind of sense of history. How do we define who we are against the backdrop of those who came before, especially those significant others? In fact, I would go as far as to say in many ways, we are most human when we stand before the coffin and have to relate ourselves and our lives to loved ones who are lying therein. It's also humbling. You could be a professor at the law school, or you could be a homeless brother outside, but you're going to have some similar shudders and quivers when you have to relate yourself to the corpse. And death and the forms and varieties of death sit at the center of the tradition of struggle that Paul Robeson represents. And one of the reasons why it's so very difficult to talk about